People who've never been within 5,000 miles of Easter Island in the South Pacific can probably draw a rough picture, not of the island itself, but of the giant stone heads carved there a very long time ago. They are what Easter Island, or Rapa Nui, is best known for. Anything else you can remember? Like that trees generally don't appear in the pictures of the island? It's been a big subject in recent years as scientists weigh in with theories of what happened at Easter Island to the trees. Overconsumption by humans or some kind of natural ecological disaster? Our next guest appears to weigh in on the second option. Dr. Candace Gossin is an environmental archaeologist and also features a company called Black Coyote Medicine. Lots going on in the life of Candace Gossin. She'll be speaking tonight about her discoveries at Rapa Nui at 6:30 at the Ashland Library. She's here in the studio with me now. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Fascinated by the field itself, what is environmental archaeology?
It's a branch of archaeology. From my perspective, through the PhD, environmental sciences, my degree, it's a component of the natural history and how humans fit into that natural history.
So basically our integration with our natural systems through time, not just where we are now.
Landscape use, change of plant material through fossil pollen, those are just some of the methods that we look at.
Sounds like it gets very, very detailed.
It is. It can be quite nerdy.
Gas chromatography and all that kind of stuff?
Oxygen isotopes, things like that, yep.
So how did this become your life's work? I mean, it's not like kids get out of bed when they're 8 years old and go, I want to be an environmental archaeologist, or do they?
No.
Did they?
No. In fact, I think my childhood was spent hanging out in the fields, climbing trees, digging in the dirt, and, you know, I always go back to I'm still the girl that likes to climb the trees and dig in the dirt. But I came a different path. I spent maybe the last 20 years of my life as an architect. So I have 2 degrees in architecture. But that was through, again, working with building with earth and doing design build, building houses out of straw and earth and solar to save the trees. So the mission's always been saving the trees. So when I decided to go back to get this PhD, it was, now how can I figure out how important the trees are? Once you cut the trees, you lose rain, you lose water. How can I find a scientific method to do that? And so you look at humanity and the use of trees, and Easter Island was one of those places that was always in question. You know, did humans really cut down all their trees and cause their own collapse, or was it something else that happened?
Okay, so that was the basic question on the table. And how long ago did you first go there? How many trips have you made?
2002 was my first time. Mm-hmm. So the last 14 years I've been working on the island, and that was sort of an exploration. I joined an Earthwatch group in 2002 and met my fellow friend Chris Stevenson, archaeologist, who got me started on this path.
Where do you begin a look like this? I mean, there have already been several works out there, and I guess we're going to end up talking about Jared Diamond a few times. He wrote a book called Collapse.
Yes.
And his theory is apparently the acceptance of his theory seems to be fairly widespread, but that it was caused by the inhabitants of Easter Island, that they cut down too many trees and changed the environment themselves. And so, I mean, is that the generally accepted view? That is his work the one that has attracted the most adherence?
There's been a lot of books read and sold, and that, I think, is the general view that most people around this planet have, at least my students. And even after the lectures I give, they come back years later and say, you never told us they had bodies. You never told us about this. I said, sure. I said, okay.
Bodies? Okay, now you've got our interest peaked.
Yep. So moais, statues, bodies, trees, they're fantastic stories. So the story that's perpetuating that, you know, the humans, Rapa Nui people, cut down all their trees, became cannibals, lived in caves, and caused their collapse is sort of the fantastic story. But we've, you know, have new science and different stories to be told.
Let me backtrack then to your first visit to Eastern Ireland or Rapa Nui in 2002. Had Jared Diamond's book Collapse come out by that time? Or was it still pending? It sounds like the theory was out there anyway.
The theory was out. I'm not sure if his book was released by that time.
Mm-hmm. All right. So did you go specifically to disprove this theory or to test it? Or, I mean, what thesis did you arrive with upon Easter Island?
Yeah, I wanted to find out what happened to the trees. So the question I brought to the island to find out, was there something else besides humans that could have caused the disappearance of a huge forest of giant palm trees?
Giant palm trees.
Giant palm trees.
Okay, so yeah. let's get a scale of the island itself. Is there generally believed, and is there enough fossil record to show that the place was covered by trees at one
yeah.
point?
Yep. So this is all new within the last 20 years or so. My mentor, John Flinley, from New Zealand, did the first corings of this big crater lake, Ranaukau, which is the one that I cored. The first findings with Thor Heyerdahl in 1958 pulled up a palm fossil, a palm tree fossil, pollen. But the work got stopped then. And it wasn't until John Flinley came back in the 1980s that they did an actual fossil pollen analysis and found there was a lot of trees that were not there anymore. And that set the foundation to my work that followed.
We were talking to Dr. Candace Gossin. She's an environmental archaeologist visiting Ashland, and she'll be talking tonight at the library at 6:30. You can join us now on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Easter Island, Rapa Nui, the giant heads, the moai, and the trees that are not there while the heads remain. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions or comments or observations. Maybe you've been to Easter Island yourself. We'd like to hear your impressions as well. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. What does bring you to the Rogue Valley? I haven't asked that question yet.
It's beautiful here. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Shakespeare Festival. You know, so a visit lended to an opportunity perhaps to land and stay for a while and teach at the university. And there it stands.
Okay. I'm still looking for the opportunity.
Still looking.
Develop. Okay.
Yep.
Easter Island itself, I never heard it called this before, the navel of the world.
Te pito o te henua.
Uh-huh.
The navel of the world. So if you look back in most cultures' origin stories, they all have some center of the world. And to the Rapa Nui people, they were in their center of the world, the navel of the world. Yeah.
And for the folks who don't know, because I had to go refresh my own memory about where Easter Island is, it's considered Polynesian, but it's pretty far from places like Hawaii. Yeah.
Yes.
So where is it?
The Polynesian Triangle, right, beginning over in far west Eastern Asia to Hawaii, down to Easter Island and back over to New Zealand is considered Polynesian territory, all inhabited at different times. But the easiest way to get there, say if you're American, right, fly from L.A. or Dallas down to Santiago, Chile, and then another five-hour flight west, another 4,000 kilometers to the west. So it's a very isolated place.
That is a long way out there.
Yeah.
What are the restrictions on traveling there, if any? I mean,
none.
There's really none.
No. Nope.
And you get there with just a regular conventional flight?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So once you got on the ground there, how did you go about your work? I mean, this is a fairly big canvas and a big subject. It's like, well, what happened to the trees here? So where did you head, and whose work could you follow in the footsteps of?
Well, my work is unique, which is interesting, and I had never done that before. So when I landed in 2002 for this Earthwatch group, I met Chris Stevenson, an archaeologist who was working on the landscape changes, and discovered this idea of lithic mulch, that it really was volcanic. It wasn't just volcanic rock that was spewed all over the landscape. It was actually used to grow plants. And so it was an adaptation. And I'm really interested in adaptation. So he's the one that suggested, look, you're looking for things in the past. We can't get back to long record with archaeology. Why don't you core the lake? And that's where it all began.
We have a message here from Boyd in Wolf Creek. He talks about the Klamath Siskiyou province, where we are here talking from, hosting rare plant communities, including trees on arid serpentine soils. Has your guest any observations on our unique natural assets? And I wonder if this ties in with the kinds of things you studied in Easter Island, the ability of that island to support plant life as large as large palm trees.
Sure. And is he asking how, if I've looked here in this area?
Both, I think, yeah. I'll expand it to both anyway. Thank you, Boyd.
Well, I'm going to answer general because I haven't spent a lot of time looking at the ecosystem here, but I will. It's what I do when I land. Going back into the fossil pollen record gives you all of the plant types that were living at a certain time, their quantity, and how they changed over time. And through that, I looked at also the fungus and the bacteria and all the little things that you can get in a little micro slide smear, and recreated the ecosystem, the ecology, and how it changed over time. It was a completely different environment than what you see today. You could identify that as a subtropical palm forest, where there were 16 million trees existing on this island at one time. And the trees were the largest palm trees on this planet. They were 6 foot diameter by 80 foot tall. And once you lose the keystone species, then the other species then begin to disappear as well.
How can you tell from just pollen that you had 6 foot diameter, 80 foot tall palm trees?
Well, all these methods put together, right? Oxygen isotopes tell me about water. Water evaporation changes in the lake and the ecosystem. The fossil pollen gives us all the plant type changes. The archaeology tells us about what humans were doing and how things were changing, whether they were using wood for fuel or grass roots for fuel. Kind of gives you an idea how the landscape was changing. You put all those pieces together and you create a story.
So were you looking at just the ecological end of things, or were you digging in sites where people had lived as well to look at some of the things you talked about, like how humans used the plant life there?
Most of my work and all of it is in that lake. So there is human habitation in and around that lake area, but I have supporting friends and colleagues that do the archaeology that we work together. So in 2014, I'm not going to give you too many cues ahead of time. You have to come tonight to hear the story. But we uncovered a new site in 2014 that had never been discovered that has some palm cast roots in it. So I'll leave it at that.
Really? So something bigger than just the microscopic?
Something bigger that humans are related to.
All right. I was going to ask you if there were things like stumps even around there. Anything that large? Anything in the macro? Because it sounds like you're really dealing in the micro a lot.
Well, there's a group of archaeologists, Meath and Bork, that came in and actually looked at the cast roots, the negative remains of the trees.
There were no spaces where the roots were.
Right. And the tap roots were, 18 feet deep. They were quite huge. So you could tell the size of the trees by what was left behind. But there's no material. There's no stumps. There's no branches. There's nothing left on the upper landscape at all. But by measuring the distances between these trees, they could then model what they supposed existed there. And their calculations came to 16 million of these trees through 90 holes that they found.
It's really interesting, though, to think about the dimensions and trying to figure what existed above the ground based by what you find in negative space below the ground.
Well, you have to associate that to something that's living. So you have all these facts from the past, but the closest cousin lives in Chile. So there's a palm tree there named Jubaia chileensis, which is the close cousin. And you can identify that through the endocarp, the seed, and the fossil pollen. So we look at that, and then you can overlay, right?
Candace Gossin has been looking for what happened to the palm trees on Easter Island or Rapa Nui. We'll be talking about it, as she referenced, tonight at 6:30 at the Ashland Library. You can join our conversation now on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 to get in on the phone, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I get more fascinated all the time with the use of core samples to figure out what things were like in the past. We have the evidence in Greenland of what the atmosphere was like thousands of years ago by what is trapped in the air bubbles in the glaciers there. We know a lot more about the Cascadia subduction zone, which could make our lives a very ugly one day because of the core samples being taken in bays along the Oregon and California coasts, for example. But the way you have to go down to the microscopic level, it sounds like in your work, you really are talking about getting down to the point where with pollen, you're looking for stuff that you can put in a microscope slide.
Yes. Well, let me tell you what it's like to core the lake here. So lake sediment cores are real similar to ice cores, but you have organic matter. So to me, it's really fascinating. I get oxygen isotopes out of the same, which comes out of the same ice core. But this Lake Ranakau is an old volcano. So imagine an old crater lake that blew up a million years ago and left a crater that was a kilometer and a half across. And sometime in the past, a living mat of plants grew across. And the rain came in and it pushed by pressure these plants to de-root and then become a floating mat. So the way that I have to work in this lake is by climbing down the crater wall and then walking across this floating mat, literally over 12 meters of water, hand carrying all this gear in. And then you find your place, and then you have to, you know, puncture through this mat, 12 meters of water, and then you pull up meter by meter this sediment. And in the sediment, you sample, subsample, right? And you can radiocarbon date. So the little Scirpus seeds, I radiocarbon dated in Lawrence Livermore and then took some samples and did the oxygen isotopes and then the fossil pollen. And in there you have tephra. You have evidence of volcanic events. You have the isotopes that tell you about global events. So it's a nice picture of the world and big events like that that were happening that made an influence on that small little place.
You talked about having to lug all the gear across this this mat on the lake. I mean, how much more did you weigh going back in the other direction with samples on you? How much stuff did you take out?
Well, the core that I used for most of my work was 9 meters deep. Right, so 9 meters of core hauling back out, and the trick, if you come to the lecture tonight, of course, is looking at the floating mat. It's not solid; it has holes, so you have to jump across or throw your gear. And the fear is always you're going to drop something down and lose it. So not only yourself, so you're just a muddy mess and. It's great. It keeps most people out. They don't want to do that, but I like it.
It sounds fun. But as you mentioned, digging in the dirt back in your childhood, this is very much like that, isn't
it?
Just with more sophisticated equipment. What do you use to get the cores out? Does it look like the snow survey poles or something?
Oh, no. It's all hand.
Really?
Hand coring. It's a piston core, so you take 1 meter out at a time. Sheer grunt labor.
All right. So you are twisting a pipe into the ground, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's and then you have to carry the pipe out. How do you check baggage? Onto planes. How do you get that stuff back?
Oh, let me tell you a story. So the customs is concerned about things that, I came back, I was given a gift with a chicken feather, which is made into ornamental hair pieces. Mm-hmm. And I'm carrying bags of sediment that are 15,000 years old with fungi and bacteria that no one has any idea of what's living in there. And they were more concerned that I had a feather that had blood, dry blood, than the soil. So they got distracted, and the cores went right through with no problem.
Are there any pathogens that might have come back with those cores?
No.
Okay.
It's lake sediment. It's hiding underwater, so things are, you know, clean.
I'm still fascinated by the idea of fossilized pollen, though. I mean, how small are we talking about here?
Oh, you're talking about 10 microns to maybe 200. Yeah.
So really, really small.
Yep.
We were talking again with Candace Gosson, an environmental archaeologist who's been exploring on Easter Island, trying to find an answer for why the trees disappeared. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley emailed. He asks about the cedars of Lebanon. Any parallels there?
Oh, no. Okay. But maybe he should tell me about the cedars in Lebanon.
Oh, well, he didn't get to that part of it. I noticed NPR carried a piece about 3 years ago that was another version going against what Jared Diamond had talked about in his book Collapse, which, again, the theory being that Easter Island was denuded by the residents there, just cut all the trees down, and then the rest of them died. And the NPR piece was about the idea that rats caused the deforestation. Was anything that you turned up indicating in that direction?
Hunt and Lippo have been writing that story for a while, and like any ecologist, you know it's not one thing. It's many things that work together to make an ecosystem weaker. Their theory is plausible, but I disagree with it as being the cause. And the findings that we found in 2014 in this new area found a whole cache of endocarps from the palm trees that did not have rat marks on them. And that's their whole theory, is that all the seeds were eaten or had rat marks on them. It's certainly something they're chasing. So, you know, you can't dismiss their science, you know. Go for it and keep uncovering things, and we'll learn more.
Keep proving it or not.
Yeah.
As the case goes.
Right, right.
But so, go ahead.
I was going to say, we have a film that I'm going to show this evening that the BBC came out and put together in 2014 that has all of us that sort of have a different theory, climate, earthquakes, tsunamis, various other things that I'm going to show as well. So it's good to get other perspectives of other ideas.
I looked at some of the work that you've already presented about Easter Island, and it looks like some of it has been presented at conferences. There are entire conferences to talk about Easter Island. So people, scientists get together and talk about what in God's name happened to the trees regularly.
Oh, there's people all over this planet that love to talk about Easter Island. Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. So it looks like from the work you've published already that your theory is roughly about climate change causing the disappearance of the trees there.
That's right. And I can't disclose it all, but I uncovered, like most climate scientists find, cycles and patterns that repeat themselves that make an impact on ecosystems. And if humanity changes the landscape, the ecosystem will change. If you have a repeated climate cycle that comes back through, you either adapt or you die, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the whole two. Whether it's modern day or whether it happened 15,000 years ago, it's the same thing. It's how diverse and adaptable your environment is, human landscape, environmental landscape.
It occurs to me to ask at this moment if we're thinking binarily too much in the West, if maybe the issue is that it could have been a number of different factors. It could have been overconsumption and climate change.
Absolutely.
Really, these things can occur together.
That's right. We have very short life spans, so we don't like our environment to change because we get used to growing a crop for X amount of years. But when these cycles come back and change, we have to adapt to that. And certainly, it's our use of that land based on those opinions or that bias, and then something comes in to change and it doesn't work anymore.
Just a couple of seconds left. Is there any one definitive thing that scientists would need to find that would close the book, drop the mic, otherwise give a definitive answer to what happened there?
On Easter Island?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we already know. It's just a matter of everyone reading the right stuff.
All right. So the material's out there. It's just a matter of everybody
agreeing
upon it. Oh, that. Interesting stuff. Okay. Candace Gossin will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Ashland Library about her findings at Rapa Nui, Easter Island, talking about what happened to the trees there. Again, 6:30 tonight at the Ashland Library. Dr. Gossin, thanks for joining us in the
Thank
exchange
you.
Today. Good to have you.